Good evening, wildflowers, friends, everyone. Lovely spring evening here. Because we change time, it's light now, as it is probably for all of you, wherever you are. Or maybe the farther south you get, maybe it's less pronounced. I don't know. It's all relative, right? It depends where we are. And yet the truth is that it's very simple. It's very easy and simple, this practice, if we are easy and simple ourselves. So today, we had a discussion with someone not related to practice. And of course, everyone this morning was talking about the economics, the economic plan of Mr. Trump. And someone said that. He with this that this plan of tariffs, of raising, making others pay more, was a way of destroying interdependence. And I this was such a weird thing to hear because interdependence can't be destroyed. It's the very nature of life. And if we go against it, well, then we cause harm, obviously. Someone, I think it's the guy, David Stendel Rast. I forget if that's really, I think that's how his name is pronounced. He's a Christian monk. But who's also practiced Zen, and he says, you know, we're in the time of a plague of othering. This plague, this contamination, a pandemic of othering, of creating the other, of creating the idea and indulging in a notion of other, whereas there are no others. And he said, this was not in relation to Trump today, but I think it was during the election, the American elections, saying that strength against others is an illusion because there are no others. That the very act of being alive means to be in relationship, whether it's breathing in and out. The air, the collective air that we all breathe, whether it's sharing the natural resources or polluting the natural resources, or you name it, we're in relationship. And when we don't see that, we see how much harm is caused. This is what our whole practice is about. Rejecting any part of this one body is the root cause of suffering. So, when I heard this comment about Trump's tariff plan, and what's ironic too about it is if you, I was a journalist in the 1980s when I was a young journalist, and Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher were taking down all of these blockades to trade, making, opening the markets because it would make them richer, of course, but opening the markets, and then became this concept of globalization and free market. And this was like the absolute doctrine of, in America, what we call the Republican Party. Today, in America, what we call the Republican Party is like, driving the final nails into Reagan's coffin. It's like ending all of that global markets, globalization, free trade, ending all of that. It's all relative, right? When we look back, I said, so Reagan, it's fascinating to look at how this works because our practice applies to it. So Reagan is acting from a place of greed, anger, and ignorance as well, and of wanting to get rich and wanting to make his country better and profit, take advantage of, these markets and have everybody buy American products. Trump is doing the same thing, the same root, greed, ignorance, and it's just using a different method to get there, right? The interdependence does not change. The consequences of actions are there, whatever the actions are. At every moment, however, as we know, we have the possibility of either compounding the toxic, intolerant, violent behavior, or abandoning it. That is, let go of it, not indulge in it, not grasp it. Every moment. And that in each one of our lives, that's the truth. It's true on a global scale. It's true for anything you can name. It's true. We can indulge in the or compound or grasp, or we can let go. And we know that there's a big, we feel the difference when we grasp and when we let go. But then, of course, we can say, well, what in this situation, what do we do? What do we let go of? It's interesting that in this notion of othering, there's the precept of I refrain from blaming others and elevating myself, or is it the other way around? I refrain from elevating myself and blaming others, something like that, because they go hand in hand. When you blame someone else, you're elevating yourself. When you put, it's even the language is interesting. You put someone down, or you, and by doing that, you raise yourself. And we very quickly can be engaged in that transgressing of that precept because we say, oh, those people are bad. Those people are stupid. That person, that woman, the way she's dressed is ugly. That guy has dirty shoes. I don't like them. Or it's just endless. The way that we blame others and elevate ourselves. We can see this in, economic policy today. We could see that it's all about blaming the others for being bad and exploiting us. And the language is just unbelievable. The blaming language of others are to blame for what I feel and who I am and what I'm experiencing. Whereas the truth is, we're all each responsible for our own experience, for what we feel, how we behave, what choices we make of whatever it is, whether it's what to have for breakfast in the morning or not have breakfast in the morning. There's this intermittent fasting thing, so people they don't eat those people don't eat breakfast in the morning. And people who do eat breakfast are not bad, and people who don't are not good. But we have fixed ideas about if what we should eat in the morning and if we should. Maybe you, the rest of you too, I don't know. But when I was a child, it was my mother was on us to eat breakfast, We had to eat something before we went to school. And when I was like a teenager, I was like, no, I don't want to eat breakfast. And so she convinced me to drink this horrible instant breakfast thing that they had. I don't know if that still exists. It was pretty horrible. Just kind of makes my stomach ache even to think of it. But so you see, we have these ideas. My mother was coming from a place of it's healthy. Children need to eat three meals a day. They have to have something in their stomach before they go to school and whatever. People doing intermittent fasting, you can't eat for 16 hours. And for whatever reason, I had a conversation with the woman who cleans my house yesterday about this because her daughter, who was like university age, is doing intermittent fasting. And she's worried about it. The woman who cleans my house is very worried about it. And I said, it's a fashion, and she's probably got her reasons for doing it. It's probably not going to hurt her. Don't know. She's a college student, so she's probably healthy otherwise. I don't know. But we have these ideas. So we have, an idea that we're going to make the other people pay if they don't buy our products or something. It's just these ideas that have no foundation apart from greed, apart from attachment to an idea of self and other. So this plague of othering is really interesting. I liked that phrase. And the notion that strength against the others, it's a total illusion because there are no others. So what do we do? So, if we Dogen likes to remind us to have our practice be total, whole, undivided, no separation, sincere, wholehearted, authentic. All of life is practice. Every moment, every activity, that's why when we work on koans, we say all the time. If you have an obsessional personality, kind of like I have, it's really easy to do that because I become obsessed with it. But it can also be a def, not an advantage because then we become so obsessed with it that we crush it, or something. But it means to really make your whole life the practice. And that means, you're willing to be open, curious, not thinking about this is practice, but just being it, something like that. And if that's the case, if we move through our life, if we experience and take the steps through our life with that posture, that there's really a difference. It doesn't mean we don't suffer. So like that the story that I tell sometimes of when I left my, beautiful apartment in Paris and my great independent life with I was a single mother with my small child, to move to the Zen Center in what at the time was this horrible neighborhood, on the other side of the Paris Ring Road, the Périphérique, which to Parisians is like, no, don't want to live on the other side of that road. And I didn't want to either. But the inspiration and the motivation of making all of my life the practice was so powerful that I didn't let go of the attachment. I let go of the apartment and the neighborhood I was living in. My apartment was in this beautiful 18th century elegant building. My daughter's school was in a 17th century hotel particulier. In the Marais, which at the time was not yet what the Marais is today, but her playground was the Place des Vosges, which is the oldest square in Paris. I let go of that. I gave that up to go live in this dumpy neighborhood on the eastern edge of Paris, because I wanted to make my life my practice. And fortunately, it was so powerful that I didn't let my head get involved. I suffered immensely letting go of that old neighborhood. For months, I could not go back to that neighborhood. I couldn't even set foot there. My daughter's school here in this neighborhood was really scuzzy, kind of. This is like a really working class neighborhood with not a lot of money. And I felt guilty for her, like putting her in this new situation. But I did it because of this the call of the Dharma, the call of making my life practice and making practice my life. So I go live in a Zen center, pregnant with a kid, with another little kid, and that's going to be my practice. That's my life. That's my practice. I didn't leave my job, so I still had to go to my work, and my daughter still went to school, had a normal life, but that was also practice. So I didn't let go of the attachment, but I let go of what I was attached to. And then eventually, I let go of the attachment through practicing. You let go of one attachment, it doesn't mean all the attachments are let go. But even the fact of one side of the peripheric and the other doesn't even really have any meaning for me anymore. Of course, geographically it does. Administratively it does. I had to give up my Paris postal code when I moved here, which was really also, I was really identified with my Paris postal code. But I let go of that because I wanted to clarify my life as the enlightened way. As the practice. And that was so powerful that I could just drop it. And then it wasn't until there was a super major metro strike, when, unlike any other metro strike, transportation strike I've witnessed, where there were no metros, there were no buses. The metro stations were closed. The screens, what do you call them? The doors were closed. You couldn't even go in the metro station. And it went on for several weeks. And I was on maternity leave, so I didn't have to go to work, but I did have to get my daughter to her father's because her and her my me and my her father shared custody. And she went on the weekends to his place. So I had to get her across to the other side in Paris, but the other side of the city. So we used to go in the car with my now husband, but my partner. We drove her in just unimaginable traffic jams. And one day we had to take a route that took us right through my old neighborhood. And all this time I had avoided it, but I had to go. And as I did, we drove past the Place des Vosges, which is absolutely this fabulous, elegant, beautiful place. As we drove past, I really almost wanted to close my eyes, but I didn't. And I looked, and it was amazingly beautiful. And then we drove on and past another something, I don't know what. And everything we passed, I just looked and it was amazingly beautiful. All through the city as we drove, it was amazingly beautiful. There was no more, this is better than that. There was no more that pain of, it's not mine anymore. It was not mine. It was never mine, right? And that's when I realized that the attachment had been dropped, which meant that I could appreciate everything. Whereas before, I could only appreciate that neighborhood. was only that. That was mine. It was that little bit of Paris. The rest of it, no. I could even come back to what was then a dumpy neighborhood. It's completely changed in 30 years, but, and appreciate it and appreciate the house we lived in the Zen Center, which was always a nice place because we renovated it and turned it into a nice Zen Center. But, changed everything. Just having first let go of what I was hanging on to. It takes time, you know. It takes time to let attachments to fall away. I didn't blame myself when I was still attached. I didn't really even think about it much, except that I didn't want to go in that neighborhood, and I still felt the pain. And that when we do that, it opens such a wide space and it brings so much peace and ease. One step, one moment at a time. So every moment is a letting go and continuing. To the next moment, the next moment, the next moment. I like my watching my grandson learn to walk. So you see a little baby learn to walk and they fall down all the time. And if they had, you know, if they were projecting into what it meant to fall down, they wouldn't stand up. They wouldn't even try, you know, if they were like us. But the incentive, whatever it is that makes human beings stand up and walk, is so powerful that they do it. Every baby does it, unless there's some, you know, physical disability or something. But they each do it their own way, at their own moment. But they do it. It's so inspiring. You know, to watch this baby just get up and then fall and then get up and then fall. And not being deterred. So, can we do that with our practice? So, we get caught, we get attached, we forget, we plunge into some, you know, blaming others. And it's really easy to do. It's really easy to do. It's just as easy, however, to make it simple. To look and say, oh, yeah, okay. What am I doing? What am I doing with this? Keep the focus on your path, you know? Or, like we say, look closer. So, when you're blaming all those people who voted for Trump, look closer. Or even blaming Trump or blaming whoever your leaders are or blaming your neighbor for, you know, building something in the apartment at 11 o'clock at night that keeps you awake. Or, you know, blaming the municipality for not picking up the trash on time or whatever it is. Or the concierge who doesn't bring in the trash bins when they're supposed to, or something. When we do that, just look. Okay, I see I'm doing this. Okay, I see it. And even in the midst of, you know, the most difficult situations, that feeling that is a call to look closer. Ah, I'm behaving in this way. So look closer. You know, step back or Dogen, you know, turn the light inside. What is this? What's going on here? This doesn't, like I always say, you know, this isn't going to solve every problem in the world, but it does resolve or dissolve. Our self-attachment for a moment. And then that may come back, and then we do it again. we do it again. Someone said that, like war and tyrants can silence, thousands and millions of people with a single act. But peace is made moment to moment, person to person, relationship to relationship. It's a different functioning, and yet it's not. It's like choosing to create harm or choosing to create something beneficial or well-being, something like that. And as we know, like that quote that I love to from Jesus Christ Superstar, where Jesus comes into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday and they're going to arrest him. The Romans are there to arrest him. And he said, you can silence me, but the rocks and trees will keep saying it. So, you can silence one voice, but it's still speaking. It's still there. And silencing one voice gives rise to other voices. So, I guess, the message for us is to keep our eye on the path, keep our eye on the point, remember to come back, remember to turn your the light in. Remember the little babies learning to walk and falling down. That's us too. And then get back up. And when we feel pain or suffering, remember that's okay. That's what the Buddha said. It was, that's why we came here. That's why we're doing this, is because there's something that called us to this, that was not satisfactory in the way we were living. Whether it was a question, I really want to understand this, or I want to know who I am, or I can't really even identify what it is, but something called you here. Something calls you everywhere you go, but in this case, it's our practice that we're talking about. So something called you here. And usually it was something that wasn't working, or something you couldn't answer, or something that was dissatisfying, or looking around and seeing, the state of the world and saying, wow, this is not how I would like it to be. And then recognizing that that makes how that makes you feel. Whether it's anger, sadness, pain, disgust, frustration, powerlessness, whatever it is, well, then that brings you here. And that's a sign to look inside. Moment to moment. Interdependence can't be destroyed. And I said that to the person I was talking to, and they agreed. They agreed that it can't be destroyed. And it seemed to, when we say that, it's because it seems so outrageous what's being done, especially because we know intuitively that everything is interdependent. It just seems all the more unreal, surreal. Because it is. No, it's going against the fundamental nature of life. And our practice is to see the true nature of life, to awaken to the true nature of life. So somewhere we know that there's something not right there, not right in the sense of doesn't make sense from our heart life. So I'll stop there. I have to plug in my computer, which is running low. And here, if anyone would like to share anything or comment, questions, other subjects.
Hello.
Hello, João.
So from what I understand, you deliberately put yourself in an uncomfortable position to leave the Dharma. That was the reason for doing it.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. But it was uncomfortable for a number of reasons, but at the same time, it was what I longed for because I was living with my teacher and with other Zen students. And it was what I really wanted. But you're right, I put myself willingly into that really uncomfortable situation. It's true. And living with your teacher is an uncomfortable situation, I definitely. One of my Dharma brothers who was living there with me at the time, Frank Roshi, he just was really uncomfortable because he thought our teacher was watching what he ate, how he dressed, what he did in his spare time. Well, I mean, she was, but she wasn't. You know, she wasn't like that was not the point of her existence was to watch what he ate, you know. So, but it's true. Yeah, good point. But I might say, you know, when I first heard it, it sounds like, you know, I was making myself a martyr of myself or something. It wasn't. The point was not to be uncomfortable. Yeah, and it raises the question is what are we willing to do for this practice? You know, are we willing to make this life as it is our practice? It doesn't mean, you know, moving into a Zen center with your teacher. I mean, none of you have that option, right? But it wouldn't even have to be that. It's your life as it is. Are you willing to make that your practice?
Hello, because there also seems there's also some liberation in that. I don't know if you were aware of it at the time, probably later, but in a way, of course, like you said. Of course, you were, well, I don't know if it was the living with your teacher. You were with your teacher and with your Dharma brothers, so you wanted that. But you know, you had to let go of these other things that you mentioned, and that can also be liberating in a way. Being able to do that, being able to do that, or deciding to do that, or something. Going, you know, going this, going where you don't want to go, or something.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I wasn't doing it with the idea that it would be liberating. I didn't even know that what that meant. And there were some things really, really from myself and my family that we sacrificed because, my husband and I, we had one room. And that was our bedroom, our office. It also often was the room where the Dyson line was. People waiting for interviews with our teacher. My daughter had a bedroom, and then my son, for the first 9 months, he also slept in our bedroom. All of us shared a kitchen. There were like, how many of us were there living there? I don't know, 10 or something, 8 of us, and we all shared a kitchen. And then when there were retreats, there were like 40 people who arrived. And so our house was this house where we lived already collectively. Suddenly there were like 35, 40 people there. So, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of sacrifices, but I wasn't thinking of it in terms of this is liberating. It was in the end. I mean, that's is the result. But it's like we say, you walk, it's like walking through a meadow at dawn, and you don't do it to get wet, and you don't even realize you're getting in wet until you leave the and come onto the paved road and you realize your shoes and your trousers are wet. I wasn't thinking that I was, of course, I chanted, this is the path of liberation every day. But I wasn't thinking, I didn't know that. I wasn't mature enough in my practice to realize that. And it's something that we come to experientially, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I knew that. And was willing to make all these, sacrifices. And my daughter, however, many years later, so my daughter who lived there until she was 14, said to me many years later, I don't know, she was living in the US at the time, and I don't know what the subject was, but she said, "Mom, well, what if I just want to be a soccer mom?" And I said, "Well, you can. Why not? And she said, and I said, "Would is that really what you would want to do?" And she said, "Well, I didn't actually have a normal childhood, and I had never thought of that. I really didn't because I thought she had a pretty normal childhood. Of course, it wasn't." She lived for 7 years in a Zen center, but I don't think she has any regrets. Now she sees the people who she was living with at the time as like aunts and uncles, and feels very close with them. So there are things that, yeah, it happens. There's stuff that happens that we don't imagine, and then ultimately, for me anyway, it was a path of liberation, and I think that my children are different for it. Having a, they are different in their lives than if they had not had that experience, I think, and if I had not had that experience. They have a freedom that I didn't have when I was their age, let's say, something like that. I just realized that most of you have no idea what a soccer mom is, So there's me and Soshin and maybe Debbie, I don't know. Or maybe Lisa knows what a soccer mom is. Joelle knows what a soccer mom is. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's just, like the moms who are devoted to their kids and drive them to soccer matches and to dance classes and live in suburbia and probably have a full-time job too and multitask and do all this stuff. Kind of, can have a pejorative term, but not necessarily. It's a sociological category, let's say. Another category, another way of othering, right?
It's interesting that in ancestral societies, usually, families kept living in the same house. Grandmothers, the kids, everyone lived in the same house. And this idea that we should all have our little space is, part of that disease of fathering, if you can say so. And also, I thought that there's this interesting link between the Buddhist perspective and science, scientific method, in that scientists are supposed to look for ways in which they are wrong. So this is a kind of a defense against othering or illusion or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, scientists, they don't start out from, I'm right and I'm going to prove this. They start out looking how, yeah, exactly. And it is, I feel, I don't know when I was like going out on my own if I would have felt this, but I do now feel it's kind of too bad that we've lost that families living together. The generations, but it's a different world. No.
Well, if I may say something, just commenting upon your experience and your decision, I guess that had to do with the need, of course, you felt to, but you just said so, to jump into your own quest for to find out who you were or to find out what's the meaning of all this. And in that sense, I don't know if it's not to say that, of course, you didn't make sacrifices, but I don't know if it was really a sacrifice or if it was something that, in fact, for you and well, also your family, because I think it did. In that sense, there must be some, I don't know, I don't want to go into personal, but I guess that there must have been some talk with your husband to join you. But it's how I feel it. I mean, if the spiritual path is just perhaps a deep research in our own need to find out what we are doing in the end. And some people need to join a community, and I think that's the reason for the existence of monasteries, for instance. And in a way, perhaps what we have done is comparable to people who join a kind of institution that is ruled by certain norms that allows one to pursue his own quest. So I think somehow the fact that we are now here, this group together, is also another way of doing it, perhaps. Perhaps a more, I don't know if it will be a more comfortable way. It's the possible way of pursuing a spiritual path. And in the end, that has to do with the importance of a group, I would say, to sustain your practice. And you must have felt the need to do that. Perhaps nowadays with the internet, perhaps you would not have done it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason that in Buddhism, also in other spiritual traditions, but in Buddhism there is this emphasis in the group that has a lot to do
with your own choice. I mean, you needed to join this larger family, let's say, under the guidance of someone that you rely and that you felt it was someone that you could learn with. And so I think that's, yeah, that's yeah, yeah, I can understand why you say that you had to leave behind things and work out your attachment. I think that's when we dive in something that we feel that is precious for our life. Of course, we have to leave behind many things, but perhaps it's not leaving behind. It's just to get rid of things that preclude us to go deeper in our way of finding out what we are doing here. So, but I'm very thankful for you to share your own story, if I may say so.
Thank you. Well, and it's true that each of us has our, call and need and circumstances. Today, my teacher would not, she, after I left, it was that no more people with children were going to live there. So the people who had children, they had a different circumstance. We all have a different circumstance because we don't have a fixed place, and I don't have a house that allows me to live with students, and so it's different. 30 years ago, we could not have even imagined that we would sit on a screen like this and talk together for an hour and a half on Thursday night. It would have been like, what? This kind of thing you saw in Star Trek or something. I remember seeing those. In science fiction movies, they would have like things where you could be on the phone with someone and see them on a screen, and it was like this really science fiction type thing. But here we are. So we respond to the circumstances, and with what we have, the ingredients we have, keeping our eye on the path. So what is the path? And what is our way? And what does that mean to practice? If you've chosen to walk on this path that I'm walking on with these people, there must be something that resonates for you in it. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it.
Course, yeah.
So, yeah, whatever it is.
Although I must add, if I may say something else, that is also something that we take it, we should take it if we can do this and if we are allowed to do this. It's also because somehow we are lucky. I'm saying this because yesterday or 2 days ago, I just saw, yeah, a documentary. Is a movie, yes. It's more like a documentary with the title Innocence, and it's about, and the subtitle is a country where one cannot be a soldier or something like this, and it has to do with Israel. It's really worthwhile to be seen because I don't know, that depends on the circumstances, as you were saying, but this is innocence is because this is a documentary with written testimonies and also some clips, video clips of kids. And some of them you could see they were very sensitive and all that, that had many difficulties to join the army, and they were forced to join the army, and they were resisting. They didn't want to go to war, and they were seen as weird people. And in the end, you find out that these testimonies were from young people that went to the army after all, but they commit suicide because they could not stand. they didn't want to kill. So sometimes I wonder, I mean, that there is, and of course then you have all, you end up in all these metaphysical questions. I mean, where I was born is a lucky place. If I was born, I don't know where, in Gaza or Israel, perhaps that was a sign that we have done something wrong with our previous lives. I don't know. It's so absurd that you are born in a place that you don't have many chances even to pursue a spiritual. And perhaps in also in those circumstances, there are people who find out some light. That happens, of course.
Oh yeah, there are plenty of people in Israel who have deep spiritual practice. But
I mean, really, in the middle of a hell, see, to find light, it seems that happened in even in the concentration camps with people that somehow
That's
wake up to life. But
Eddie.
of course, that is that should not be the that should be to be born in a country that somehow you are forced to kill people. It's already. And this is a very, very interesting documentary. It's for the Portuguese people, if you are a subscriber of Filmin, it's a Filmin thing. So yeah, anyway.
Well, and it's true, so we can consider ourselves fortunate. Sometimes we consider ourselves not fortunate to be born where we are and when and whom and this family or that, or to have experienced some, trauma or something. Whatever it is, what do we do with this one precious life that we have? And this one precious day. Who was someone? I think it was Claudia. Didn't you have some quote from Thich Nhat Hanh who said, when you wake up every day, what do you say? What will I do with this day? Or wasn't there something like that? No, someone from Thich Nhat Hanh told me that. Yeah, wait.
Yes.
Yeah.
Remember, the fact is I don't remember because it's a long time I didn't read it, but I used to read it every morning. Oh, but it's like every day is a new day. So what am I going with the next 24 new 24 hours that they
Yeah.
are
What will I do with these next
given?
24 hours? Yeah. This life as it is, my beautiful little life. What is it? What is it? Who am I? What is this? And sometimes we're called in circumstances. I have this picture that you can see back here that Anna gave me. It's this famous picture from Lisbon during the revolution. All the Portuguese recognize it instantly, I think, right? And so these people, there's a soldier there with a gun, two soldiers with guns, and then there's a little kid like bending down talking to one of the soldiers, and another kid like looking at the soldier. These people standing on the street, they're all called to act in that moment. And that wasn't so long ago, at least two of the Portuguese people on this screen were alive at that time, and experienced it, So, and yet every moment is like that. So we're called upon every moment. What is it? Do we go towards harm or do we go towards peace? What will we do with our 24 hours today? So.
And I don't remember the sentence, but I remember the idea that every morning I'm a new one. I mean, I'm not the one that I was yesterday. I'm a new person, and so it's always like every morning I wake up and I'm new. It's everything is new, everything is different, and I'm new.
That's right. And the same goes for every moment. So every moment I'm new. Exactly. And how I am today, is what I did yesterday has an effect on how I am today. If I they, had a big party and drank lots of wine and ate all kinds of bad food, well, then I will feel that today. Or if I went on a long hike, I will feel that today. So that's how karma works, So it's not so much that we did something bad and so then we're suffering today. It's a result of where we are, what we did before. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Amy, I'm thinking because it's coming while you're talking, and something is coming up right now is that I can feel because you say, okay, so something brought you here and you keep on practicing and meditating, and this is really, for me, this is what is very strong at the moment is like, because now I'm practicing for a while now, and that I meet people around to practice and everything, and at this moment in my life I can really feel the change. Something is really changing, like, because I'm surrounded by people that are practicing a lot, and I can really feel that it interfere in my life because I'm really surrounded by it's not nice. The world is not nice people, but like maybe people who practice, so that's easier, right? Like everything is kind of different. So my surrounding is really changing, and I think it's much more easier to live in that atmosphere, because when something happened to me, like I'm always like, I don't know, it's much easier for me at the moment, just because around me it seems very solid. It seems very I don't know, yeah, maybe solid, something more solid. But I think this is really because I'm practicing for a while now, and that, okay, something like this. I can feel it lately, very strong.
Yeah, that's Sangha, and that's also what happens when we have this shift and we then devote ourselves to our practice or turn our attention to it. Then that also results in who we are associating with, because that's part of it. Some people, it's not that we don't like the people we associated with before, but maybe they have other interests and they're doing other things and you're doing this. So you do find yourself then surrounded by people on the same path. Or at least maybe sometimes it's not necessarily the same path, but with a, looking in the same direction or something, maybe. Yeah, Claudia. And then
And it makes me think to what happened last week. I think I told you when we were in Dokusan, but when I went with Milo, when Michel proposed a circle, and I went there with Milo, and there was such a—I mean, for me, it was a present, like it was like a huge present, like to propose to my son to go to a circle and to be in that circle with Milo and to discover the voice of my son that I've never heard before, because it was in the circle. And for me, I thought I was like, that day, I thought I was so lucky, like to be able to invite my son in this circle and to be surrounded. I mean, oh, I knew the people, and it was so, I don't know, it was a very, I think it was a huge moment for me. It was yeah, it was great. And I felt so lucky, and I felt, yeah, I was very lucky. And I think Milo was impressed. So he could be in touch with what I'm doing. So it was great. It was and it's part of it too.
Yeah. And that's a choice that you made to on you d decided to devote your evening with your son to that instead of, like, I don't know, playing video games or going to a restaurant or even to the cinema. It was like that's what you chose to do with your son that night. And that's Yep. One more thing, then we have to stop here.
He invited me to the restaurant after the circle.
That's right.
Myself.
Yeah.
First I had the circle and the restaurant.
Which is also wonderful, you know. I know when my son invites me to a restaurant, wow, it's quite an event. Okay. Thank you. I think we have to stop now. Thank you all.